amendment, what it says and what it's actually intended to do. And then in the second part, I'll address some of the legal arguments that you would have heard and try to explain them. So I'm just going to work out what my timing is and when I need to stop. Now, as Cecily said, with the slides, I'm going to give them to the group here. So it may well be, depending on timing, I'll skip over some bits, but you'll have them there. And in particular, at the end, I give you a list of links to other people and sources for anyone who wants to. So all of those will be available for people. You don't need to worry and take notes or anything like that. Okay, so let's quickly go through the referendum procedure. So it's set out in section 128 of the Constitution, and one of the tricky things about it is that there's a double majority for a referendum to succeed. So that means you have to have a majority of votes across the whole country, and that includes the territories since 1977, and also a majority of votes in a majority of states. And because we have six states, that means not 3-3, but it means 4 out of 6. So the upshot of that is that you only need a no vote to succeed in 3 states, and it's enough to knock off the entire thing, even if a majority overall still votes for it. So that does make it problematic. So for example, in 1977, there was a referendum question that received the support of 62% of people overall, but it still failed because it didn't get the 4 necessary states to agree. The other thing to know there is that informal votes aren't counted when you're trying to work out whether or not there's a majority. So that's why sometimes you see a bit of a disparity in terms of the numbers, but that's the explanation for that. And also the other thing is voting is compulsory. So just like voting is compulsory in ordinary elections, it's also compulsory in a referendum. Okay. Now, section 128 says that the referendum must be held not less than 2 months nor more than 6 months after its passage through Parliament. Now, the reason for that is to give people enough time to learn about the question, so Parliament can't just spring a referendum on you. You have at least 2 months after it's passed Parliament to be able to think about it and learn about it. But also they don't want it to get stale. They don't want, you know, a referendum to be passed and then, hey, we don't actually sort of hold the amendment to be passed in Parliament and then not hold it for another 2 or 3 years when everyone's forgotten about it. Mm. So for that reason, there's a particular window to hold this referendum in. And because the referendum bill passed on the 19th of June, then you run those 2 month, 6 month periods from then. The most likely referendum dates are either the 14th or the 21st of October. That's because of a range of things like football grand finals, school holidays. But also, one of the critical things is the wet season in the Northern Territory, because they won't be able to get polling booths out to places if they wait too long. So they can't wait till the end of the 6 months because of that. So that's the reason for suggesting, it's either going to be probably the 14th or the 21st of October. As you'd probably be aware that there is this thing called a yes-no pamphlet that gets sent out to all voters, and there are laws about how that's comprised. So the majority of politicians in the parliament who voted yes, they get to decide what goes in the yes side of the pamphlet, and the majority who voted no get to decide what's in the no case. If no one in the parliament votes no, then there isn't a no case, there's just a yes case, and that's what happened with the 1967 referendum in relation to Indigenous Australians. But in this case, as we know, people have voted no, there will be a no case. As for the people organising the no case, personally, I don't think I'm going to be organising it because the people on the no side come from very different points of view. So that will be, you know, potentially quite entertaining as to how they manage that. Because it's written by politicians, there's actually no obligation for it to be accurate. In historically, yes-no cases have been highly misleading. From time to time. So don't expect it to be informing you particularly, because the point of it isn't to give you accurate information, the point of it is to manipulate you to vote one way or another. And that's what makes it a flawed document. And it always has been. Anyway, nonetheless, we will have it, and so that will come to you at some point. Section 128 says that for a constitutional amendment to pass, you must have that double majority. So this is the thing about the actual question that's asked on the paper, because it's a bit weird for legal reasons. Okay. So what you're doing when you're voting at a referendum is that you're voting to make the specific change, that wording, all right, to put into the constitution. But the wording itself of that change is not on the ballot paper. Because, for example, when we had the Republic referendum, there were so much words you just wouldn't be able to stick it on the ballot paper, right? So instead you get asked a question. And what the Constitution says is that when you're voting in a referendum, what you're doing is you approve the proposed law. Okay, so what you're doing is you're approving that proposed law or that bill that puts these words into the Constitution. So because the Constitution uses that terminology, when we get to the question on the ballot paper, it can't ask you a general question like, do you agree there should be a voice or anything like that, or do you want a republic or any of those sorts of questions. It can't ask you that. What it has to ask you is what you have to do to get this thing passed, which is approve the proposed law. Okay? So you have to get asked whether or not you approve a proposed law, and how do you tell what that law is? You tell what it is by reference to what's called the long title of the bill. And so because of all of that, the voting paper looks a bit weird. And I'll show you an example of it in a moment, but what it does it will say a proposed law to alter the Constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. Do you approve of this proposed alteration? And then your job is to write yes or no in the box provided. So let me just show you what it looks like. That's a previous one. That's the 1999 one in relation to the preamble. So you'll get strong instructions at the top, write yes or no in the space provided, and then you'll get that description of what the proposed law is, the proposed law to do blah, and then at the bottom it says, do you approve of it, and you have to write yes or no. Okay, everyone got that? Mm-hmm. It is just a bit odd, and so if people don't understand it, they think, why on earth did they do it like that, just to confuse me? No, there's a reason for it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's now talk about the background of the voice. So the voice proposal was developed in response to the rejection of a previous proposal, which had included putting an anti-racial discrimination provision in the Constitution. So you might remember Tony Abbott said, oh, it's a one-line Bill of Rights, and it was opposed, etc., etc. So the idea came about of, well, instead of having, so with that anti-racial discrimination provision in the Constitution, what would have then happened is that if Indigenous people thought laws made by the Commonwealth were racist, they then have to go to court and get lawyers and then have litigation, and that raises a whole lot of problems. It's expensive, it's really time consuming, and there are risks, particularly if you lose, because you might have to pay the other side's costs. Okay, so for all those reasons, it's not really a very good thing. So the idea for the voice came about saying, well, why don't we flip the whole approach? So instead of dealing with something after it's been done and trying to attack it in a court with litigation, let's go the other direction and see, instead of using law and litigation, let's try and use political influence to better inform Parliament or the executive government before they make the laws and policies in order to try and get a better outcome. And the idea was always that it was just supposed to be influence. So the idea here was that if you give sensible, good suggestions as to why this law will work better on the ground and in the way it affects people, then Parliament is likely to pay attention to you, because generally Parliament and the executive actually do want good, efficient laws that have good outcomes, right? And so the idea here was that Parliament and government will accept sensible, helpful, practical advice that better informs them so we can get better outcomes. That's what it was all about. It wasn't about vetoes, it wasn't about demands, it was simply about just having that opportunity to have a say and possibly influence Parliament and the executive to make better laws and policies. So that was the idea of it. And the second thing about it that attracted me to it was that it gave, instead of giving the agency to the lawyers in the litigation side, and, you know, it all being outside of the hands of Indigenous people. By flipping this process, it's actually the Indigenous Australians who were the ones who were out there doing and influencing and taking control over their own lives, right? So it was that kind of active involvement rather than the passive involvement of just being the client to a lawyer. And the best thing I thought about that was that we talk about constitutional recognition, okay? Recognition, when it is simply just putting some words on the page of a document that hardly anyone's ever read, okay, is not terribly helpful. Now, I can say that to you because, and here's a little question for you, how many of you knew that Indigenous Australians are recognised in the state constitution of every state in Australia? Anyone? No. And so that recognition that's in those state constitutions isn't actually very practical. It's not achieving anything because it's symbolic. People don't know about it, particularly because none of the states required a referendum to put it in there, okay? And it's really not terribly effective. The way this voice proposal was intended to be recognition is something far more practical because it's continuing recognition, because the recognition happens every time the voice is heard. Every time Indigenous people are given the respect of just being listened to, they are being recognised. So recognition is not just words on a page of a document. Recognition of this kind is ongoing, it's continuous recognition. And I have to say that really attracted me to this particular idea. So, where did the proposal come from? Well, originally it was developed by Noel Pearson, along with some conservative lawyers who were Greg Craven, Julia Lisa, who was at some point the Shadow Attorney General, not anymore, and Damien Freeman, Shireen Morris, and I was brought in as the constitutional technical advisor. So I was the person who was asked to turn this into something that works constitutionally. So my role. So when I tell you about what was intended at the beginning, I know because I was there. Okay. It was then later put to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander groups in dialogues across the country under the Referendum Council, along with a range of other proposals. So there were, I don't know, seven or eight different types of proposals of when Indigenous people were asked how they wanted to be recognised in the Constitution. I'll give it a whole lot of different options. Changing the race power in the constitution, putting up in a preamble, all those sorts of things. And of all the options, this is the one that they chose by a very long way because they liked that idea of the continual recognition, the practical outcomes coming from it, not just words on a page. So even though it was written by a lot of people who weren't Indigenous, obviously Noel was, but the rest of us weren't, it really did come up from the grassroots of Indigenous people when these dialogues took place around the whole country. It didn't come from a political party at all, certainly didn't come from the ALP. To the extent that anyone political was involved there, it was actually on the coalition side, ironically. But it was the Indigenous people in these dialogues that adopted it, and then it was adopted at Uluru in that national dialogue in May 2017 and formed part of the Uluru Statement of the Heart, from the Heart, along with Treaty and Truth. The wording, so I wrote some wording for this originally back in 2014. Mine was pretty good, by the way. been a bit fiddled around with since. Not necessarily as well, but anyway, we'll pass that by. Nonetheless, Prime Minister came out with a version of it in Ghana in 2022, and it was later fiddled with a little bit more as a consequence of the advice of the Constitutional Expert Group, which I was a member, and the Referendum Working Group, and also some advice by the Solicitor General. So the wording has altered since 2014 numerous times, but the idea has remained completely the same. Okay, so here's the wording that we've got. So if anyone hasn't seen it before, this is it, okay? Sometimes when people are shown it, and they say, is that all it is? Because after all the carry-on and fuss and all the rest of it, you think it's some big, scary, weird thing. But when you actually read the words, actually, not very much. All right, so what does it do? The first little bit there, you've got some recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the first peoples of Australia. So that does two things. It's a statement of fact, okay? That is the fact. And it's also an explanation for why this has been put in the Constitution. And one of the key things here is in giving that reason, it's a response to the people who say this is all about race and dividing our constitution and dividing us by race. Actually, it's not about race. It's not, race is not the reason. The reason is something different, and that is that these are the first peoples of Australia. So it's about being Indigenous to Australia. It's not about your race, okay? And so that's set out there in the first line. And then in the first little paragraph there, that guarantees the existence of this body to be called the Voice. The second one gives it a function of making representations. We'll go through these in a bit more detail in a minute. And the third one then says, and Parliament does all the rest of the stuff. Why? Because you don't want to freeze into the Constitution all the detail, because if you did and you discovered it wasn't working particularly well this way, you wouldn't be able to change it. Okay, so that gives you the flexibility for Parliament to come in and regulate how the Voice works, work out how it's comprised. If you've got a problem with it, you can change it. Okay. So the only things that are put in stone are the things that say it has to exist and it has this function of making representations. Everything else you can change by legislation. Okay. All right. So we're going to go through that in a little bit more detail here. So I've probably already said this. So this is the stuff about the introductory words, first peoples. By the way, back in 1999, when John Howard proposed a preamble, he actually used the words, he included recognition of Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders as the nation's first people. Okay, so this is something that Coalition was happy with back in 1999. As I said, it makes it clear it's not about race, it's about indigeneity. Section 129.1, that's the one about the existence of the Voice and guaranteeing it. It can only be given substance, however, by some kind of legislation. So you need legislation enacted in order to comprise it, because otherwise it's got no members. Okay, so you need the legislation. Parliament can't be compelled to enact that legislation. The High Court doesn't impose positive obligations. But once you do enact that kind of legislation, then if you tried to repeal it without replacing it with anything else, then the legislation trying to repeal it would probably be invalid because the Constitution requires the Voice to exist. The Voice is also constitutionally recognised as a body, and that means it has its own capacity to do things, including making representations. So that, in legal terms, makes it a legal person. And that means it can do all sorts of things that another legal person, like a human being, can do. So it can own property, it can employ people, it can spend money, and do all those sorts of things. 129.2, which is the one that's been most debated, it guarantees the capacity of the Voice to make representations to Parliament and the executive government on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. It says may there, it doesn't say shall, so the word may there is permissive. There's no obligation on the Voice to make representations about any particular thing. The Voice can choose to do it if it wants, but it's not obliged. So, but the word representations, that's confused people quite a lot. It's a word we don't use terribly often. Earlier versions of it, including mine, had the word advice. The reason the word advice was dumped was because as you know, when ministers give advice to the Governor-General, that kind of advice is, from a constitutional convention's point of view, binding. And there was a concern that we didn't want to imply in any way that advice would be binding. And so that's why the word representations was chosen instead to replace advice. So what is a representation? It just means some kind of a statement formally expressing a point of view on behalf of those people that are being represented. So it could be a complaint, it could be a request. Okay, it's not a demand, it's not compulsory, it's just saying, this is what we reckon, okay? Ball's now in your court. So the representations can be made to Parliament or the executive government, but Parliament under, sorry, that should be 129.3, sorry, slight error there, can determine the procedure for doing that. So for example, Parliament could say, all right, no, Voice, you can't go and talk to every single public servant, etc. We're going to regulate this in a sensible way. We're going to say all representations by the boys have to be in writing. They have to be sent to this one particular portal. We'll then put them online for everybody to read and, you know, distribute them appropriately. But Parliament could do that. Okay, so a lot of the hysteria about, oh, the voice is going to be sort of telling the head of the Reserve Bank what to do and all this sort of business, okay, it's just silly. There is power here for Parliament to regulate how there is that interaction between the voice and the executive government. The other thing important to say here is that Section 129.2 contains no words that impose any obligation at all on Parliament or the executive about considering or giving effect to the representations. That's left to politics. Okay, that's left to the fact that if government and Parliament are told something sensible that would improve their laws, then one would hope they'd do the sensible thing. Okay, there's no legal requirement there for them to pay attention or listeners. And sometimes people say, well, what's the point of doing this? So they're not compelled to do it. And again, the point is that it's not supposed to be a legal obligation. It's supposed to be a political or a moral obligation. It's or not even an obligation. It's simply the fact that if a parliament is better informed, it's likely to make better laws. That's really what underlies the whole thing. And it's something that people don't get because they seem to have in their mind that for anything to work, you have to be compelled by law. Okay? But most of us do things not because we're compelled by law, because it's the right thing to do. Okay? And this somehow has got missed out in this entire debate. Okay. Now, another debate and argument is about the scope of the representations. You would have seen in Parliament recently people carrying on saying, oh, well, can they make representations about this, or can they make representations about that, and it's all too wide. Okay. So it says in there they can make representations on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So, is it too broad? Should you confine it to something like directly affecting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples? Well, it needs to be broad because there are many laws of general application that do have a particular impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So if you try to confine it to only laws addressed to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, you'd miss out a whole lot of laws in relation to everything from, you know, education and health or whatever that have a particular impact. The example I've given to a number of people is what if the Commonwealth made a law of general application that said that in order to vote, everybody had to have photo ID? Okay? Now, the people who are less likely to have photo ID in this country are people who are Aboriginal people from remote communities. Okay? And so that would be something that the voice would be perfectly entitled to point out and to make recommendations. Could say, well, you know, we don't like your law at all, or it could say, well, if you're going to do a law like that, then you need to have a program going out into remote communities to facilitate ways for either people to get photo ID, which would be helpful, or at least find some kind of alternative way to identify them so that their right to vote is not limited. Okay, so that's the sort of reason why you want a broader thing. The second reason for doing it, and this does come from my original drafting, so I can tell you precisely why those words were chosen. And that is that if you put in terms like directly affecting, then we would end up in litigation forever and a day with people saying, well, does this thing directly affect Aboriginal people or not? So the idea was make it really broad, okay, on whatever they can make representations on whatever they like, and leave it again to politics to focus them in. Right, so where does the politics happen here? Well, first of all, the voice is going to have limited resources, okay? No one has resources to do everything that they want. So if you've got limited staff and limited money, you have to focus on the things that are most important. Secondly, you've got a constituency of Indigenous Australians, the people who choose the members of the voice, whether it be by election or some other means, okay? And how happy are they going to be if the voice spends its time trying to tell the government what submarine to buy instead of dealing with issues that affect Indigenous people, okay? They'd be furious. And any members of the voice who were going out doing silly things, advising on things that had no relevance to Indigenous people, would be kicked off pretty darn quickly, you would imagine, right? And then finally, Parliament has power itself to reconstitute the voice, to change the way it's comprised if it goes around doing silly things. So for all those political reasons, voice is going to have to focus on the things that most matter and are relevant to Indigenous Australians. They're not going to be worried about submarines or parking tickets or the Reserve Bank, right? They're going to be focused on the things that are important. And it's better to leave that to politics rather than to specifically put in words like directly affecting, because those words, directly affecting, would lead to all the litigation that people say, oh, we can't do this because it's going to lead to litigation. Okay, the really curious thing is the people who say, oh, worried about litigation, are suggesting putting in the very words that would make the litigation. Okay, so that's why that didn't happen, and we shouldn't be doing it. Okay, last one there, section 129.3, powers of the parliament. Section 129.3 gives parliament power to legislate, to govern the composition and operation of the voice, and to confer other functions on it. So those other functions might be things like interacting with state bodies, because there's a huge issue here about how do we manage this across the nation, because frankly, most laws that affect Indigenous people are state laws, right, and local laws, actually not Commonwealth laws. And most states are now sort of creating their own voice or doing something like that, so how do we make it all interact and make it sort of sensible and seamless? You need an ability to do that. And again, it's Parliament that gets to do that under Section 129.3. But Parliament's power is subject to this Constitution. And they're magic words that most people out in the ordinary community don't realise are magic words. But that does then mean that Parliament's powers in relation to this are subject to express and implied constitutional limits. So, for example, I've heard people say, oh, well, Parliament could allow the voice to legislate. Well, no, it can't, because of those magic words subject to this constitution, because it's chapter one of the constitution that gives legislative power to the parliament. Parliament can't abdicate that power. It cannot say, we, the parliament, can't make a law unless you, the voice, give us permission first. Can't do that, because that would be contrary to the terms of the constitution in chapter one that gives them that power. Okay? Chapter one is not changed, and those words subject to this constitution subject the laws about the voice to that. Equally, you couldn't give the voice judicial power either. Okay, so there's a whole lot of constraints built into those words subject to this constitution. Okay. Subsection 129.3 is also subject to subsection 129.1. And two, so that means that Parliament couldn't legislate to abolish the voice unless it replaced it with a body that did the same thing, and would not be able to abolish or restrict its ability to make representations to Parliament and the Executive on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So they're the two key things that the Constitution requires to continue to exist. But Parliament could regulate how the voice makes those representations. It could legislate about how the executive interacts with the voice, etc., etc. So that's how it all is supposed to work. Okay. Let's check how my timing is going. Okay. So here are the three big arguments that we've seen recently, and I'll try and address them. So the first one is that the amendment will introduce race into the Constitution and destroy the equality of treatment of people, which is probably something very of interest to this group. Second one is the argument that the High Court will draw an implication from the voice which requires the voice to be consulted in advance on everything and will make government unworkable. And the third is that it will give an Indigenous Australian special rights under the Constitution that aren't held by others. Okay, so you've probably heard all those arguments, so let me try and work through them. If it ends up with being too long, as I say, the slides are in existence and you can have a look at them. So you might have seen this one on the internet. It's been sent around by one of the opposing groups, and it says, race is not mentioned once in 144 pages of our constitution. All Australians are treated equally under law, served as well for over 120 years. We don't need a second voice to our parliament. Okay, what's wrong with that? Well, almost everything. you can say race is not mentioned once. It's actually mentioned twice, actually, in our constitution. So there's section 25, which is an interesting little section. It's was a remnant of the US Bill of Rights in relation to the emancipation of slaves. And so what they said was, well, hey, if you're a state and you're not going to let your slaves vote, then we're going to reduce your representation in Congress by taking out the population of the excluded people so that you end up getting less representation. So we have the same thing in our constitution, and it says that if any state stops people from voting on the basis of their race, then those people are excluded from the state's population, so the state gets less representation in the Commonwealth Parliament. It's actually an anti-racial discrimination provision to discourage it. Many people today, however, would say it's a horrible provision, gets rid of it, because it at least contemplates that the state might exclude people from voting on the basis of race. They can't now anyway, because the High Court's said that that's not possible. So anyway, it's a bit irrelevant now. 2126 is the other one. That's the power known as the race power. It's the power to make laws with respect to special laws with respect to people of any particular race for whom it's deemed necessary. So yes, race is already in our constitution, has always been in our constitution since 1901. Australians have not always been treated equally under the law. There is this fantasy constitution that lives in people's minds where we have, you know, everything like separation of church and state, and we have, you know, a right to bear arms, and I'll take the fifth, and all of those sorts of things, including equal protections of the law and due process. And frankly, none of it's in our constitution, but people just watch too much American television. That's the problem. Okay. So Australians have not always been treated equally under the law, and as we do know, people have been excluded in the past from voting at the federal level on a race base. And also, by the way, the Constitution does not have 144 pages. It's far shorter than that. So you see this thing that talk about it's not mentioned once in the 144 pages of our Constitution. What on earth were they reading? It's not our Constitution, because race is mentioned in it, and there's no way our Constitution gets anywhere near 144 pages, no matter how big you make the font. My guess is maybe they were looking at the Constitution of Austria. I'm not really sure. But, you know, seriously, if you're going to put out propaganda, you could at least, you know, read the Constitution you're referring to. Anyway, it's just ridiculous. Okay. Further comment here is that the Constitution doesn't treat everyone the same. The High Court has said specifically there is no general principle of equality in the Constitution, and there's no implied principle of legal equality under the laws. Chief Justice Brennan said that inequality is contemplated by the race power and the aliens powers in the Constitution, and that destroys any argument that the Constitution does require legal equality irrespective of race. I mean, it's very hard to imply that when you've got expressly a power that allows you to discriminate on the basis of race. In the Mulholland case, Chief Justice Gleeson pointed to what he called the entrenched inequality of the Constitution that gives Tasmanians far greater representation in the Commonwealth Parliament than their population warrants. I mean, that's the whole basis of the federal system involves inequality. And by the way, an inequality that's not necessarily bad. There can be good reasons for treating people differently. Okay, there can be good reasons for it and bad reasons for it, and you need to be able to distinguish between the two. And by the way, that inequality is also represented in that double majority that I told you about in the referendum. The fact that 62% of the population can vote in favour of a constitutional change, but it can be defeated because three states voted no. So that shows you real inequality. Inequality is also reflected in federal finance. And the inclusion of Section 96 in the Constitution about giving grants. There's no requirement that the Commonwealth funds the states exactly according to their population. States like South Australia and Tasmania have always been given greater amounts of money per head of population than New South Wales and Victoria, and again for good reasons, because they need help and the rest of us are prepared to provide that help so that everybody can be treated in a way that allows them to have the same levels of services, etc. So here we've got to distinguish between equality as a notion of treating everyone exactly the same, as opposed to what's known as substantive equality, okay, where you take into account relevant differences. So those who are disadvantaged may need additional help to reach the same standard of services and opportunities as others, and that's true for the small states in Australia and the territories, but it's also true for Indigenous Australians as well. And in addition, indigeneity is also a relevant difference that needs to be taken into account to achieve that level of substantive equality. And here's another interesting thing. The High Court has also recognised that sovereignty in Australia, and this is obviously a contested notion, but sovereignty in Australia is actually held now by the people, not the Crown, not by the British. They've recognised the notion of popular sovereignty. And the court has said that the Constitution guarantees that the people of Australia are able to enjoy a quality of opportunity to participate in the exercise of that political sovereignty. And that equality, they said, has to be substantive rather than formal. So again, treating people the same where there are genuine differences does not result in equality or fairness. For example, to achieve substantive equality, some voices may need to be quietened, like, you know, the rich people, so that other voices can be heard, the voices of the disadvantaged. And so in this particular case, the McCloy case, the High Court said, well, that means that Parliament can cap political donations and political expenditure because uncontrolled use of wealth can undermine the practical enjoyment of popular sovereignty by others. Okay, so if Clive Palmer manages to use every billboard in the country with his message and exclude other people from having their voices heard, then you can have a law that sort of says, well, actually, some of you, your expenditure needs to be capped so that other voices can be heard. Now, in a case the High Court cited in that particular case, which is a Canadian case called Harper and Canada, when I was going through all this, I found this fantastic quote from the Canadian Supreme Court, which talks about equalising participation in the political system. And it says this, there's two ways of doing it. First, the state can provide a voice to those who might not otherwise be heard. Or second, the state can restrict the voices which dominate the political discourse so that others may be heard as well. Okay, and so we know, for example, in New South Wales, the state has restricted the voices of others in terms of imposing caps on political donations and political expenditure. But what we haven't done yet is the first thing, and that is provide a voice to those who might not otherwise be heard. And that's what this Indigenous constitutional referendum is about. So the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to Parliament and the executive government is proposed for the purpose of enhancing the voices of those who might otherwise not be heard so that they can fully participate with equality in Australia's system of representative and responsible government, which finds its source in that popular sovereignty. So the reason for telling you that is that, well, people will say this whole thing about the voice is alien to the Constitution, it doesn't fit into our system of representative government. Actually, it fits in perfectly. It fits in with that whole idea of equality of being able to participate in the political system, which may include raising the voices of some so that we have equality across the board so that different voices can be heard. The next argument here is that the voice should not be able to make representations to the executive government. Now, this is the most controversial aspect of it. It's actually quite legally technical. I'm thinking I've not got enough time to go through it in detail, so let me just do you a very quick wash over the top of it, and it might be able to help you. Okay, so the first thing here is there's this thing called administrative law, and it says if you're a minister and you're making a decision that affects the life of a particular person, then you have to make the decision fairly. Okay, you can't be biased, you can't take into account irrelevant things, you must take into account relevant things. But under administrative law, it's the Parliament, when it gives you, the decision maker, the power to make your decision, it's the Parliament that sets down what sort of things you have to take into account. Okay, so here's an example. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Heritage Act says that when someone's making a decision about whether to protect a sacred site, you have to go through the process of, you know, advertising that you intend to do that, take submissions, take them into consideration, etc., etc. Okay, this sort of thing happens all the time. The law says to minister, you need to take this into account. If you disobey the law and refuse to do so, then a court can come along and say, minister, you haven't followed the right process, go ahead and remake the decision following the fair process. The court doesn't get to remake the decision itself. the court only gets to tell the government, go back and do it properly according to your own law. Okay. So there's nothing terribly scary or weird about that. It happens all the time, every day, utterly and completely normal. Hasn't stopped government from working yet. I mean, a big part of the problem with all the scare campaign is that people who are raising this as a huge problem don't understand we already have that system in place, you know, and it's used and works all the time. But the key thing here is it's up to Parliament to decide whether or not a decision maker has to take into account something or not. And the way the voice referendum is set up is so that under section 129.3, Parliament can say, right, in relation to these things, native title, cultural heritage, this, 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 and this, yes, you do have to take into account what the voice has said. You have to listen to it and consider it, okay? But in relation to those things, submarines or whatever, well, no, you don't, okay? Parliament can do that. So what's spooking people is this idea that, Parliament won't get to decide that because the sneaky High Court is going to come in and it's going to draw this implication that says you, the decision makers, have to take into account everything that the voice has ever said every time you make any decision, and that's going to bung up the whole system. Okay, that's the argument that's going to be made. It's a silly argument. It is made by people who do not understand the Constitution, do not understand how the High Court works, etc., etc. Now, having said that, we probably all know that every now and again the High Court will do something slightly loopy, and it will do things that I disagree with. Okay, so why am I so confident that they won't do this thing that I disagree with? Well, for me, it's because there are so many hurdles it has to get through. If there was one or two, they might be able to knock them over. Okay, but when there's about six or seven really significant hurdles, I just don't think they can. Okay, I can't go through them all with you here, but there's a whole lot of slides that try and explain why I don't think this will happen. But it comes down to, first of all, the text doesn't support it. Okay, and text is the key thing that judges look at in terms of the Constitution. Secondly, the intention doesn't support it. And in this particular case, we have specific things that have looked at this argument where the government has officially said, and no, it's not intended to do X, Y, and Z. Okay? It's a High Court can sort of wiggle around with interpretation if they're dealing with something from 100 years ago where no one had thought about it, and therefore there's nothing on the record saying, no, you can't do it. Okay. Here they've got a real problem because there is a formal record saying, no, you can't do it, this is not intended. How does the High Court overturn that? It's basically impossible. So we've got this stuff in the second reading speech of the minister, in the explanatory memorandum, in the Solicitor General's opinion, all these things that the High Court has looked at previously. So that's another one of the barriers here. I've got a little case here in Gurner, where the High Court specifically says, and I'll get down to the key thing, where they look at the framers of the Constitution, the intention, and they say it would be a distinctly unsound approach to the interpretation of the constitutional text actually adopted by the framers to attribute to that text a meaning that they were evidently united in rejecting. Okay, well, we know that the government is evidently united in rejecting these things. We know that the whole parliament rejects it too. Maybe not Lydia Thorpe, but everybody else. And the High Court knows it too. Okay, so absolute Buckleys. So I talk about how the High Court would have... So this Gurner decision is like from 2020, so it's really recent. Okay, so the High Court, again, in applying that, that wouldn't take the view that the people seem to think it will. And then there's the whole impracticality thing. So there's a whole lot of reasons why structurally it would be really hard for the High Court to take this approach. And then there's just the argument of why do you think the High Court would want to take an approach that would cause the whole of government to gum up and not be functional? I mean, you know, do you think they're that insane? Why is it that the opposition actually seems to think that the people, many of whom they appointed to that court, are so completely bonkers that they really wanted to bring the country to the knees? I mean, it's just, you talk to a High Court judge about this and they just, it's just crazy. And again, it's also contrary to another authority as well, which is quite recent, the Banerjee case, where someone did argue once that a constitution constitutional implication should be treated as a mandatory relevant consideration, and the High Court said nah. So many reasons why this concern just doesn't hold water, okay, which is why I'm comfortable that it's not a problem. Okay, last one, and this is a quick one, is the whole special rights thing. People intuitively think that this voice referendum is giving one group of Australians special rights that other people aren't. However, it really helps to go back and read the amendment and look at it and say, well, where's the special right there? Is it given to any individual? If I had an Indigenous person standing here, could I say, well, that person has a right constitutionally given to them by the Constitution, which I don't have? And the answer is no, because it doesn't give rights to any individuals. Okay? Best you can say is it creates a body. Okay? There is a body that will exist, and that body is able to make representations to Parliament and the Executive. It doesn't give any rights to any individuals. That body might be comprised of 10 or 20 people or whatever, okay, but the right is held by the body, not by any individuals, okay? So no individual could assert that they had that right. Now, at most you could argue that this body has the right to make representations to Parliament and the Executive, but so does every single other person in this room, and indeed every other organisation as well. Have a think about it for a minute. Does any law stop you from writing a letter to a minister and asking for something? Does any law stop you from petitioning Parliament or writing to your Member of Parliament? It doesn't. Nor does it stop this organisation, okay, or any corporation or anybody. All right, all of us can do that. And then people say, well, hang on a minute, but the voice has got a constitutionally protected right and that makes it special and different. Well, actually it doesn't, because all of us have a constitutionally protected right because of the implied freedom of political communication. So because of this implication of the implied freedom of political communication, the Commonwealth Parliament does not have the power to impose upon that right of yours without doing it for, and there's a whole complicated test of legitimate reasons and proportionality, which I won't go into it. But in any event, when it comes down to the Constitution limits Parliament's power to take away my capacity to make representations or the Mineral Councils or the National Council of Churches or anybody else's. So that right that the voice has in the Constitution to make those representations is exactly the same right that you or I can exercise as well. And then people say, but hang on a minute, they've got the right to elect people to that organisation. Well, actually, well, no, in the amendment there's nothing that actually says that. There's no conferral of right on individuals. It just says Parliament. Parliament can decide how the voice is chosen. Now, Parliament might well give you rights. It might give Indigenous people rights to elect. Probably will. Okay? But in the end, that's Parliament giving rights. And Parliament gives rights all the time to people. Parliament can give you a right to practice law. It can give you a right to officiate in marriages. It can give you a right to drive a car. Okay? Parliament gives rights all the time, but it's not the Constitution giving you a particular right. Okay? Now, some people say this is sophistry. Okay? Well, you might say that, but the reality is it's actually fact as well. This amendment does not give rights to any individual, special rights that are different to rights of anybody else. Parliament might give some rights later on down the track. Well, Parliament has powers. It can do that all the time. It can do that already. It did that in relation to elections to ATSIC, right? Don't need this amendment to do that. But the amendment itself just doesn't do that. Okay. So, I got to the end. So legal issues are thrown up about the voice because people are not equipped to judge their accuracy, and therefore they feel they're vulnerable to believing these bald assertions that are misleading or ill-informed. And the intention is to confuse and create doubt. And as I said before, the most insidious argument is if you don't know, vote no. The last thing I want to leave you with is that voting in a referendum is a sacred responsibility that has been entrusted to the Australian people. Most people in most countries are not entrusted with that responsibility. Their own governments didn't trust them to decide this. But we have been entrusted with this for over 100 years. It was incredibly radical when that was put into the Constitution. Okay? So we need being entrusted with that responsibility. We have to take it seriously. And that means if you don't know, it's your moral obligation to find out, because you have been entrusted with that serious responsibility of voting in a referendum. Therefore, you must give back to the people who entrusted you with that by taking it seriously and learning about the facts. And finally, for you, in terms of going out, what can you do? Well, simply talking to people that you know about the voice, about issues, is one of the best ways of cutting through. Best not to preach at people or tell them, you know, that they're wrong or that they're evil. It doesn't tend to convince people otherwise. But it can help if you say, well, you know, I hear what you say. I can understand why you're concerned. But, you know, I'm less worried about it because I went and I heard this talk and I got this material and I found it really useful and I thought it was actually quite convincing, this, that and the other. That kind of gentle persuasion is more likely to achieve that. Mm. Now, if you do need to look at other sources, so as I said, I'll hand over the slides so you can look at that. ANU's got some nice FAQs that are quite easy. University of Melbourne's Conversations About the Voice, so they held a number of sort of... you know, proper meetings and presentations with experts and whatever. You can watch those on YouTube, on a video channel. Law Council Australia has done some really good fact sheets for general public, but also has a quite extensive guide for lawyers, which goes through all the legal issues in chapter and verse, so it's actually quite good. And then there's me, who's also quite good. So I have a YouTube channel, and my goodness, it was a challenge working out how to do the technology, I can tell you. But anyway, my YouTube channel has a whole lot of videos where I go through all of those sort of arguments. The whole thing about executive government, special rights, you know, all that stuff. So there's a video about all of them. So if you ever want to say, hey, I saw this person, she was amazing, you can say, by the way, here she is. Here's the link. Have a look. See what you reckon. And also Cheryl Saunders, who's a professor. In fact, she taught me constitutional law, so she's sort of like my constitutional law mother, so to speak, at Melbourne Uni. She's done one as well. Hers are sort of quite sort of short, simple ones. Mine are a little bit more explainy. But, you know, if you coped with what I've explained to you today, it's that level of explanation. So if you can understand it, then hopefully your friends who are confused can understand it too. So thank you very much. I hope it was helpful.
Am I confused? That was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much. Lots of things I didn't know, and I think I'm a bit better informed, so thank you for that. But we just need to take a few minutes for you to have a little bit of a buzz there together, just where you're sitting, just to get yourself a little bit relaxed and start thinking about, is there anything else? And in cover. Sorry.